Good morning. I heard myself say good morning. I didn't particularly hear yours, but that's not your fault. It's just I'm waterlogged or got water on the brain. The assignment sheet says that Brian Pear is preaching this morning. As much as it would be nice to be Brian Pear, I am not. And so I'll have to be satisfied with being John Kilgore. I want you to open your Bibles to John, the 7th chapter, and we want to start looking at verse 14 in just a moment. As soon as you get that, just mark it or hold your finger there, and then I want to introduce it with a story. True story. And then we'll read the text and make our point about it from Scripture. I've had the responsibility several times to serve on juries. Maybe you have as well. Probably you've been called to serve on juries more than you've been selected, as I have. I've been called many, many times. I just wonder, am I the only one in Harris County that gets called as often as I do? I mean, I've been called at least 6, 7, 8 times to serve. Maybe you as well. Well, I look like I'm not alone. And I've had the privilege, I believe, as a citizen, to serve on at least 2 juries, and maybe more. I can't remember all of them. And one of them was very significant in the fact that a man was on trial for selling drugs, and the potential sentence would be very severe. But there are 2 incidences that have occurred in my jury service that serve as the introduction to our lesson. In one of the trials, it was just the impaneling of the jury. In other words, the lawyers are there to question you and to decide who they would select to serve on the jury. And each side, the prosecuting attorney and then the defense attorney, they both have so many strikes. In other words, they can say, I don't want him because I don't like the way he looks. I mean, they have so many they could strike without cause. In other words, just whatever reason they want. And they don't have to tell you, of course. And in order to decide who they will ultimately agree upon will be on the jury, they go through a voir dire, as they say, or the Yankees say that very differently than we do, and they laugh at the way I say it, but it's the way I heard it. So it means questioning the potential jurors. And so they're asking them questions. Well, this case would be totally reliant upon circumstantial evidence. In other words, no eyewitnesses, but just putting together various elements of testimony. None of them, nobody saw this man sell the drugs. So they're questioning us about, could we make a judgment? And they were questioning a gentleman to my left. We were all seated in a row, and they were kind of going down the row. And they were asking a gentleman, he said, sir, now after all the evidence is presented, and you believe that the preponderance of the evidence suggests or shows that this defendant is guilty, could you render a guilty verdict? He said, no, I couldn't do it. He says, sir, now you possibly don't understand. I'm not saying that you decide right now whether or not he's guilty or not, but after and only after you've heard all the evidence and the evidence convinces you beyond a reasonable doubt, and that's the criteria that the prosecuting attorney is charged with. He's got to show beyond a reasonable doubt that this man is guilty, could you bring back a verdict of guilty? He said, no, I couldn't do it. And so the lawyer says, why not? And the man says, because Jesus says, judge not that you be not judged. So, the next person to be questioned is me. If they can see on my little card that I'm a preacher. Guess what? Mr. Kilgore, he went through the same question. But he altered it this way. Do you feel like juror number 36? That you, because Jesus said, judge not, should be not judged, that you couldn't render a judgment either? And I said, no, sir, I don't feel that way at all. He said, well, why not? I get an opportunity to explain a fact. I mean, and I said, well, the gentleman has quoted the passage correctly. Jesus said, judge not that you be not judged. And I gave him the reference from Matthew chapter 7. But he has placed the wrong interpretation on it. Jesus later says in that passage, do not cast your pearls before swine or give what is holy to the dogs. That means you've got to decide what the pearls are, what the holy things are, and who the pigs are, and who the dogs are. You've got to make a judgment. He isn't saying, don't judge. He is saying, don't judge hypocritically or hypercritically. The Lord said, well, that's good, good, good. It's good. He didn't want all that. Well, but I got an opportunity, so I laid it out there, and I wasn't selected to be on that jury. But I was selected to serve on another jury in which the man was charged with possessing and also selling drugs, illegal controlled substances that are illegal. And when we got in the jury room after hearing all the evidence, and I was selected to be the chairman. So when we were polling everyone, we had this obstacle to get over. We had several jurors, about two or three, to say, well, we weren't there. How do we know that this man actually sold these drugs? Nobody could prove what was in that bag. Or that what was slipped back to him. Oh yes, they went to his house and they found drug paraphernalia. They found $50,000 in cash under a pillow that his wife was sitting on top of. They had drug paraphernalia all over the. They tested it and it, you know, et cetera, et cetera. But we weren't there. We just don't see how we could render a verdict at all. You say, well, what on earth does that have to do with our lesson this morning? Anybody here, were you there? Ever see Jesus? Do you ever see any of the miracles? Do you ever hear any of the apostles who said they saw him? You see, how are we going to render a judgment as to whether or not these things are so? And in our culture today, we have more and more people who are saying they regard this Bible as just a collection of what men write, stories. John chapter 7, verse 14. But when it was now the midst of the feast, Jesus went up into the temple and began to teach. The Jews therefore were marveling, saying, how has this man become learned, having never been educated? Stop. What's their question all about? Where's he getting this stuff? Is he authoritative? Is he authoritative by some means that therefore we ought to listen to him? How do we judge? How do we test whether or not he's telling us the truth? Well, let's examine how. What are some of the sources of authority? There's the authority of an eyewitness. Someone who says, I believe that I can testify this morning in a court of law that Rebecca is sitting on the second row in this worship service. You could too, if you know Rebecca. Why? Because we see her. We're eyewitnesses. All right, that's one form of testimony. But there's another form. There's the form of what we call expert witnesses. They come and they testify about things that they're schooled in, that other people have said that they're knowledgeable in. They've gone to school or they're in a particular discipline. They perform many, many tests upon fingerprints or blood or whatever. And they come and give expert testimony. So there's the authority of the expert. What is that based upon? Well, upon your confidence in their training and possibly maybe their degree. In other words, when you go into the doctor, why does every doctor that I've ever gone to see have their medical diploma plastered up on the wall? Why do they do that? And I don't know about you, but I kind of look to see where it's from. You know? If it's from Tijuana Tech, I don't know that I want that guy cutting on me, do you? Now, this guy from Tijuana Tech, he may be far superior to the guy that's got, you know, from Baylor College of Medicine or trained with, you know, if he's a heart surgeon, trained with DeBakey. What's that all about? This surgeon, I know that when Tom had his little procedure a couple of weeks ago, they told me that their surgeon had trained with DeBakey, right? And Dr. Garcia, I think you said his name was. Well, what's that all about? Well, he gets some degree of authoritative trust because of what we believe his training is. That's what they're asking, Jesus. What are your credentials? Why should we believe you? Especially since we know that you're not educated in our schools. You're from Tijuana Tech, or who knows, you don't even claim that you've been in a school. Fair question, don't you think? Jesus thought it was fair. He didn't object to their questioning him. Where do you get this authority? So they were marveling, saying, how has this man become learned, having never been educated? The question was not whether or not he was learned or unlearned, but how did he get learned? And therefore, when he tells us something that we have not heard before, or suggests that we should change in some way, should we really listen to him? Jesus 16 says, Jesus therefore answered them and said, my teaching is not mine, but his who sent me. Is that an answer? Is that an answer? Well, let me illustrate it to you this way. For those of you who know me and know my abilities and my disabilities, and I invited all of you to come over to my house today for lunch, and I tell you, I have prepared a wonderful feast, and I have cooked it myself. Who's coming? Nobody. Anne's even leaving now. The very thought has sent her to the back. She's a smart lady, I'll tell you that right now. And why? Well, John, you don't know how to cook. And you're right. You're right. But what if I told you? Yeah, I know, I didn't, but I've been going to school. And I went over, I don't know, some famous chef, I can't even name one right now, but, you know, Prudhomme or one of those guys in New Orleans. Yeah, Robbie. Yeah, Robbie would be a good one, you know. And so I have graduated from that school, and here's my diploma, and here's his recommendation that I graduated summa cum laude from the cooking school. Now, if you've got confidence in that, you're going to come. Jesus answered them and said, "My teaching is not mine. I'm not just giving you this by what I make up, but His who sent me. You can trust what I say if you believe I'm from the Father." And what were all the things that Jesus did and performed to convince people He was from the Father? He wasn't just another man. He was from the Father. On another occasion, Jesus said, "I only tell you what I have heard." If that is a good principle for us to follow too. As a preacher and a teacher, I ought to be satisfied with what I have heard, meaning this case, read. Here it is. You examine it. Because it's not from me. It's from the book. It's from the Father. So Jesus is saying, "I don't have any earthly credentials. I'm telling you what the Father has said." But then He goes on. Then He gives them a criteria how they will know whether or not. See, the next question is, well, how do we know that you're really from the Father, that you got this from God, from the Father? He says, "If any man is willing to do His will, he shall know the teaching, my teaching, whether it is of God or whether I speak from myself," merely from myself, just as a man. Then you'll know if you're willing to do. You say, what does that mean? Does that mean I've got to do it before I know whether or not it's so? Is that like our Congress that says they've got to pass it before they know what's in the bill? No, He's not saying that. What I believe He's saying is this: you must have no predisposition to not do. In other words, if what He's about to say, or what He will say, or potentially say, is, "John, you've got to change XYZ," and if my predisposition is, "I don't care what anybody says, I'm not changing," then I'm not going to know whether or not it's from the Father. There must be at least the openness, the willingness to do. I got onto this passage really kind of circuitously by reasoning and thinking about this. Many of you have gone to the universities of our land, and so have I, and we know, if you've studied them very much, that many, if not most, of our great universities are predominantly populated by agnostic or atheistic professors, especially in the sciences. Not so much in the engineering or the practical fields that, you know, I've got to really come down and get an answer. but in the sciences, it's certainly in philosophy, it's certainly in religion. And so the question comes up, if all of these very, very smart people don't believe in God, then there must not be any real good reason to believe in God. Have you ever thought about that? And why has it been so common, at least in my lifetime, with those people with whom I associated, who were highly educated at some of our best universities? I'm from a family that really believed in higher education and sending your kids to Harvard and Stanford and all the great, if you could afford it and they could get in. And we had several in our family who have and all of that. And so we have those kind of conversations at family reunions, etc. And with an uncle who had been educated at Harvard, Tulane, and SMU and other places, and was a doctor and then decided to be a psychiatrist, I could remember our discussions again and again when I was a young man. I lived with him for several months. And he would say, "Well, I understand, John. You believe in a God because you need to." You know, he explained, this desire to believe in a God is only because we want explanations about things that we can't have explanations, and so this comforts you, and I'm glad that you've got that comfort. In other words, you ignoramus. And he said it in a nice way. It was always cordial. We never fell out. In fact, ultimately, he put me as the executor of his will. But I will tell you this. He had been raised and taught to be a religious, God-fearing believer. And I went to see him one time in the hospital, and he was near death. And I went to leave. Didn't bring up anything religious. I didn't want to, you know, get into a big argument with him there. I didn't think that was appropriate. And as I began, he reached out and grabbed my hand. He said, "John, can we pray?" I said, "Well, sure, Morris. I just didn't know that you would want that." So we prayed. And there was a glimmer of hope. But God answered our prayer. He got better. He got well. He got out of the hospital. Then he went back to his unbelief. Not sufficient evidence. Smart people, really smart, educated people, don't believe in such superstitious nonsense. Why? Here's my answer. Why do so many of our truly educated elites not believe? They're unwilling to do. Don't want to do. For what is the only logical response to an all-powerful God who made heaven and earth and everything in it and us and breathes into us the breath of life? What's the only logical response? Hit our knees and worship and say, "Lord, whatever you say, that's the way it is." But what if you're unwilling to do that? You cannot live with cognizant dissonance in your mind for very long without going crazy. You're going to have to solve it. And what you will do is either come to a belief in God or give him up. And Jesus said, if you're willing to do, then you will know whether or not the teaching is of my Father or just from myself. But he goes on. He who speaks from himself seeks his own glory, but he who is seeking the glory of the one who sent him, he is true. There is no unrighteousness in him. Did not Moses give you the law, and yet none of you carries out the law? Why do you seek to kill me? Which they were plotting secretly than the multitude, either who did not know of the plots or who just lied. Either one, I'm not certain. The multitude answered, "You have a demon. Who seeks to kill you?" Jesus answered and said to them, "I did one deed, and you all marvel." Apparently, he's referring to the last time he was in Jerusalem in chapter 5 when he heals the man, you know, at the pool, at Bethsaida or Bethesda there, the pool, the five portico pool. And he's a lame man, and he can't get down into the water quick enough. And Jesus healed him. And they objected because he had healed him on the Sabbath. He had broken the law, according to their interpretation of the law. So he goes on, "I did one deed, and you all marvel. On this account, Moses has given you circumcision, not because it is from Moses, but from the fathers. And on the Sabbath, you circumcise a man." So he's saying, okay, you make exceptions to the Sabbath law. You understand that the Sabbath law must be interpreted in light of everything else that God reveals. "Do not judge according..." Let me read 23 again, sorry. "If a man receives circumcision on the Sabbath, that the law of Moses may not be broken, are you angry with me because I made an entire man well on the Sabbath? Do not judge according to appearance, but judge," what? "With righteous judgment." Jesus didn't say don't judge, just judge righteously. One of the principles of being able to do that, I must be willing to do whatever that line of thinking from God leads me to. Or at least not be predisposed to not do regardless. Here's the deal. If we've made up our mind about something that God has revealed, and it's contrary to that, and we're not going to change, regardless, we'll never see it. We'll never really understand it. We say seeing is believing. Jesus said, in essence, believing is seeing. Understanding who Jesus is and what he did and what he asked of us unlocks the whole universe. It begins to all fit. Things come together. We begin to see because we have the key. Remember that incident after the resurrection in Luke chapter 24. When it says that Jesus was speaking to the disciples and he opened their eyes or opened their understanding to the Old Testament. He showed them from the prophets, the law and the prophets. And what did he show them? That the Christ, the anointed one, the one promised, the Messiah, the Jewish Messiah, would be killed. Would be crucified. They didn't understand that. But when he showed them that, that was, if you will, that was the missing piece. It's like having a jigsaw puzzle that we used to, certainly as a kid, we loved to put those things together. My father would get enraptured in those things. And my mother says that when they first came out, my dad was a working man. He'd work 10, 11, 12 hours a day. But he'd come home and he got hooked on a jigsaw puzzle, putting the pieces together. And my mother, who didn't really care about that sort of, she went on to bed. So she went on to bed and she woke up, and the table where the puzzle was in their bedroom. And she woke up and raised up, and it was about 5 in the morning. And there he was, still at the table, and he said, there. He put the last piece in, got up, got dressed, went to work. Do you want the piece that puts everything in life together? It's Jesus. He's the Son of God who came to earth and proved by his death, his burial, and his resurrection that there is life after death and judgment to come, and that life can be had through him by believing in him as the Christ, as the Messiah. Do you want to obey him? You say, John, I never saw him. That's why this has been produced. A compendium that recalls eyewitness testimony. These men saw him. In juries, we do not have trouble understanding that we pull together all the evidence, and we're looking for a preponderance of the evidence. We're looking for beyond reasonable doubt. Not all doubt, reasonable doubt. Defense attorneys or attorneys, and prosecuting attorneys as well, will tell you that there is a form of evidence that's even better than one eyewitness or two eyewitnesses. It's 10 or 100. If they've got stories that can be harmonized, it's all the evidence. And even a case that depends upon circumstantial evidence only is the case that I sat on. What if you had one eyewitness that saw it, but he lied? How would you know he's lying? He said, well, I just didn't like the way he looked. Or he was this, or he was that. He seemed nervous. Well, nervous people can't tell the truth. But circumstantial evidence, you take this piece, this piece, this piece, this piece, this piece, and they all point in the same direction. Innocent or guilty? I suggest to you, read it. Look at the evidence. Look at all the evidence. See where it points. You then make a judgment based on the evidence. If you'd like to respond to the Savior, we're going to invite you to come. Let's stand. Let us sing.